You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
Okay, welcome everyone. I'm Paul Margie, and it's a real pleasure to moderate this panel because we've got five real stars on the question of spectrum policy to educate us today. So what we're going to do is I'm going to introduce each of our guests. They're going to have brief remarks. I'll have some questions, and then please start getting your questions ready because we'll have plenty of time for your questions as well. So welcome. Today's session is titled Spectrum, the Lifeblood of the Mobile Net. Is the lifeblood of the mobile net running dry? And we've got five folks. Matthew Hussey is Telecommunications, Commerce, Science, and Education Advisor to Senator Olympia Snowe from Maine. He deals with a wide range of telecommunications and media issues, including DTV, security, internet governance, media ownership, USF, spectrum policy, and network neutrality. Prior to his service in the Senate, he was the Telecommunications and IT Task Force Director at the American Legislative Exchange Council, and before that spent time in both the telecommunications and the cable industries, most recently for Verizon Communications. He is an electrical engineer from Georgia Tech and also has an MBA. Matthew.
Oh. Well, thank you very much. And it certainly is a pleasure to participate in this panel, given the interest that my boss has in wireless communications and spectrum's issues. I mean, it's, I think, perfect timing since she and Senator Kerry introduced the Radio Spectrum Inventory Act that really fundamentally addresses this question. Is spectrum at a scarcity? Because right now it does seem that way. But we truly can't answer that question until we have a true, accurate, up-to-date inventory of what is currently out there. I mean, it's all speculation until that point. And that is, exactly what the legislation calls for. And it is certainly impressive to hear Susan Crawford speak about the need for spectrum mapping, which just, obviously is music to the senator's ears as well as Senator Kerry's. So we are looking at this, and I think fundamentally, some people may argue, but wireless is kind of the end game. I mean, the increased mobility provides greater productivity, greater communications, and greater access. So it's a fascinating thing, just the explosion. I mean, as you can see, I think Nielsen data shows that roughly about 20 million homes have cut the cord, are pure wireless play. We've also seen data showing, if I can remember correctly off the top of my head, but just the importance that wireless plays in the overall daily lives of people. Certainly, wireless mobility provides, I think, $185 billion in productivity in 2005. So it just reemphasizes the importance that it plays in communications and in broadband. But at the same time, while we've seen a maturity of technologies, from TDMA to CDMA to OFMDA, there are issues that are still at play, such as Shannon's Law, which dictates that we hit theoretical limits on the amount of capacity that's available per channel. And the only way in wireless to get more capacity is to provide more channels, which means more spectrum. And that's what we're very eager into looking at because of the importance, and certainly wireless continues to kind of anchor, and I think that's what we've seen with the FCC data showing the incredible growth of wireless broadband. I know that there's questions about the accuracy of that, but I think the broad strokes that it paints shows some impressive growth and demand for it. So, and we certainly, I guess, caveat, look forward to working with the industry and other stakeholders on addressing this as well as comprehensive spectrum reform, because this is certainly just the first step in several initiatives that the Senator is very eager to address.
Thank you very much. Next, we have Larry Adler. Larry joined Google in 2005 as a member of the Alternative Access Group, where he focused on Google's mission on making information universally available. He co-led Google's municipal Wi-Fi efforts, including the free Muni Wi-Fi network, providing coverage in Mountain View, and he's currently working on a range of spectrum policy initiatives, including 700 megahertz, the white spaces, and the white spaces proceeding. He's also working with the satellite broadband company, O3B, to help bring affordable broadband to developing markets. Prior to Google, Larry spent 10 years at Raycom including as VP of Technology Development and VP for Product Management. And prior to ArrayCom, he received his PhD from Stanford in the specialty of control theory and spent 3 years as a senior control systems engineer at Adept Technology. Larry.
Thanks. So sometimes people are surprised why Google is interested in Spectrum. But as Paul said, if you read our mission statement, it's to organize the world's information and make it universally accessible and useful. And so it's really the universally accessible part that I think comes down to Spectrum. In the alternate access group that we have, we sometimes say that our mission is to bring the open ethos of the wireline internet to the wireless world. And to really have that openness, again, it comes down to Spectrum. As Matthew said, more and more access is done wirelessly. Whether even in your home or in this room, it's wireless access that's driving it. The wired and the wireless working well together. And what we've noticed when we've done some of our looking at usage is it's really important for people to have uncapped usage and really feel that they can tap the full potential of the internet. As soon as you cap usage and you have artificial constraints, and you just drive down usage dramatically. This really showed up in the iPhone. When the iPhone first came out, we saw these uncapped plans, usage just shot up. And when I'm talking about usage here, I'm taking just access to Google. We saw the access to Google just spiral up. So it's really important that people and the ability to have a lot of bandwidth so that people can feel like they can do what they need to do and not feel like they're constrained. So another reason that we're involved in Spectrum is really beyond the corporate interests. As Matthew talked about his boss, my boss, Larry Page, has just a personal interest in Spectrum and in technology. And the feeling is that things can be just a lot better than they are today. There's a lot of concern about consolidation of Spectrum, the inability for people who want to do innovative things to get access to Spectrum to do those innovations. It's a big constraint on the industry. We don't see the innovation cycles that we see in some consumer electronics. We don't see those in the wireless world because people are constrained by their ability to access Spectrum. And I'll end with one thought. This summer, Tim Wu is a professor out of Columbia. He did an internship, or not an internship, he was a visiting scholar at Google, and he spent some time, and the name of this panel is The Lifeblood, is Spectrum the Lifeblood. And Tim Wu drew the analogy that in the industrial economy, oil is the driver of the economy. You need oil to run the economy. In the information economy, you need bandwidth. And bandwidth means you need spectrum. And if the spectrum is constrained, if it's consolidated, if it's controlled artificially, you can see what happens in the oil and gas. You get choked off. Innovation, prices go up, innovation stops. I think spectrum and bandwidth really are the driver of the information economy and in some extent the lifeblood. And so it's a big concern to Google to see that it's efficiently managed.
Thank you very much. Next we have Michael Calabrese. Michael is the Vice President and Director of the Wireless Future Program and the co-director of the Next Social Contract Initiative at the New America Foundation. As the Vice President of the New America Foundation, he directs the Spectrum Policy Program and also co-directs the Retirement Security Program. He helps guide the Foundation's work to reform and expand the nation's healthcare system, and previously served as Director of Domestic Policy Programs at the Center for National Policy and as General Counsel of the Congressional Joint Economic Committee and as a Pension and Employee Benefits Counsel at the National AFL-CIO. He's currently completing a book that advocates universal asset building accounts to expand pension coverage and human capital investment among lower-income workers. Michael.
Thanks, Paul. I think they grabbed that bio from about 5 years ago when I first spoke at the State of the Net. But, I spend most of my time directing the Wireless Future Program. And, it's perfect to follow these two gentlemen because whether we're talking about coverage, such as in underserved areas or bandwidth, the number one issue for spectrum management really is access to the airwaves. The conventional wisdom in Washington is that spectrum is scarce. The reality is that the only thing scarce is government permission to use the airwaves. Virtually all the valuable frequencies are assigned to some federal or commercial user. But spectrum capacity itself is abundant and grossly underutilized. More than 90% of the spectrum is not in use in most places and at most times. So spectrum measurement studies, and we did one of the first of these from our roof, you know, in downtown Washington, show that even in the so-called beachfront spectrum below 3 gigahertz, there's just an average of about a 6% occupancy rate in the beachfront spectrum during a normal business day. 13% was the peak in New York City. It's about 1% in use in rural areas. So this is, you know, of course, unnecessarily wasteful because unlike other public resources such as oil, water, or timber, spectrum is infinitely renewable. Every millisecond we don't use some of it, it's wasted, and yet it's always there replenished. Although a frequency is assigned for use, it can still be white space or underutilized on a number of different dimensions. So this is why it's so abundant. It's often not used on a geographic basis, in time, in other words, it's only used part of the time or seasonally, spatially, or by angle of reception. Now, most of this white space is reserved for government use. In fact, there are huge bands set aside for the federal government that register hardly any use at all in urban and suburban areas, at least at the ground level, because most of it's actually for air telemetry and so on. So, for example, from 225 to 400 megahertz, from 1755 to 1850, just those two is 250 megahertz, which is comparable to what the entire cell phone industry uses today. And it registers negligible, like less than 3% use in urban and suburban areas. There are also privately licensed bands that are not in use or not built out, especially in rural areas. So there's three ways we can expand access and productive use. One is by identifying bands that can be cleared entirely. They're lightly used, they could be cleared. And that's how we got the AWS auction in 2006 that put some new spectrum in the hands of companies like T-Mobile. Second is what I would call an overlay, which is to fill in unoccupied frequencies, particularly on a geographic basis. And the example there is the TV white space, where on November 4th, the FCC, voted 5-0 to open all of the unused TV channels in each local market for unlicensed device sharing for broadband and other innovation. And then third are underlays, which are opportunistic sharing of an underutilized frequency band using smart radio technologies. An example of that is the upper 5 gigahertz band, which is used for fixed Wi-Fi backhaul on a shared basis with military radar. So when military radar is not in the area or pointing in the other direction, they sense and they use it, or they sense the radar and they get off that frequency, in less than half a second. So we believe the greatest potential overall lies in opportunistic access. We should open all unused spectrum for non-interfering use, millisecond to millisecond. It's not easy, but let me just finish by mentioning three steps we can take to start that process. First is what Matt Hussey's boss, Senator Snow, and Senator Kerry proposed, which is spectrum mapping. We need an inventory of the airwaves. It would be great to have, even before a bill can pass, perhaps, a White House initiative using the stimulus funding for broadband mapping, which is intended to map the nation's broadband capabilities. We should just go ahead and use some of that money to begin a survey of both assigned and actual uses, frequency by frequency, including actual measurement data. As Dale Hatfield, who's kind of run all these different agencies like NTIA and at the FCC, has said that the government can't manage what it doesn't measure. So that's step one. Two is a joint initiative to open unused federal bands. Based on the inventory of actual use, we can identify the technologies, the incentives, and the rules of the road that will facilitate shared access to federal spectrum in particular, because that's really the next motherlode after the broadcast band. And then finally, we need a rulemaking or a series of rulemakings at the FCC to add available frequency bands to the TV white space database. The FCC will shortly be certifying a geolocation database in order to facilitate the use of the empty TV channels by discrete geographic area. In other words, you have a device and it looks up whether the channel, what channels are available where you happen to be in the country. Well, there's no reason to limit that database to the TV band frequencies. So we really think that this could be a kind of a win-win for everybody to first map, then open all of these bands on a non-interfering basis.
Great. Thank you very much. Next, we have Michael Katz. Michael is the Surin Chair of Surin Chair of Strategy and Leadership at the Haas School of Business, a member of the Haas Economic Analysis and Policy Group, a professor in the Department of Economics, and the director of the Center for Telecommunications and Digital Convergence. He's a former Deputy Assistant Attorney General for Economic Analysis at the Antitrust Division at the Department of Justice and former Chief Economist at the FCC. He graduated with a degree in economics from Harvard and received his doctorate in economics from Oxford. Mike?
Thank you. It said on the program we're supposed to make predictions about the future and supply and demand for spectrum, so I will do so. And the beauty of being an economist is I don't have to know anything about the consumers or the producers to safely predict the following. On demand, as long as consumers perceive the marginal cost of bandwidth to be zero, demand is going to be greater than supply in urban areas. Okay, there's no doubt about that. And one of the amazing things is I think we do continually talk about spectrum and spectrum shortages, and those of you who haven't blocked it out of your mind because of all the painful memories, if you took an undergraduate intro to economics class, they usually tell you this whole talk about shortage doesn't really make any sense. If you have market clearing prices, there aren't shortages. So what do you mean by that? It means, what we really mean is we'd like more of it for free, which, okay, that's true, but so what? So I actually think one of the things in all of this is that we ought to think more seriously about the use of the price system than we have. Economists say this like a broken record, but someday, or a broken CD, or a broken file, I guess, to be continued. But that we need to think seriously about it. And it seems to me actually a lot of the issues that we have and all these claims of discrimination and are you against certain services, et cetera, would go away if we thought about what really is the shadow price on this stuff. I mean, we moved at least to a large extent to pricing out spectrum, but we ought to think about what that means going through to retail prices. And I think people think, oh, you know, pricing based on bandwidth, you know, that's so last century. Well, it seems to me we may want to rethink that. Second prediction, on the supply side, which really is the government demand side, sounds familiar. As long as government agencies don't pay for spectrum use, they're going to want to keep it. And they're not going to want to give it up, and they're not going to have incentives to use it efficiently. And I understand that this mapping bill, and I applaud the bill because it's short, which increases the probability the members will actually read this one before they vote on it. But, of course, it doesn't guarantee that. But, you know, I think an important part of that, and I'm sure the authors are aware of this, is going to be the exception at the bottom, which says, okay, well, the military can keep what it's doing secret. I mean, my understanding of this from people who have done spectrum mapping is that there are huge amounts of spectrum that are used for military radars, and if that's all declared, you know, big secret and you know, national security, then it seems to me that will go a long way to undermining a lot of what the authors of the bill are trying to do. So it seems to me that is going to be a tough area for us. I certainly wish them success in that. But, you know, making the agencies start to pay for this stuff would also go a long way towards government agencies figuring out ways to be more efficient, to encourage underlays, particularly if the revenues were targeted for them. This has been tried elsewhere, and I'm told was successful. Third thing is not a prediction, it'll be a statement, which is there is no single business model that's the best one for innovation. Right? It's fashionable nowadays to say the internet is the greatest driver of innovation ever. First of all, that's false because almost certainly electricity or the harnessing of electricity and the use of it's been a bigger driver unless somebody has a steam-powered internet, for example. And plus there are all sorts of other things. In fact, you can even argue whether air conditioning has been a greater contribution to product. This is a serious point. People have studied it. A greater contribution to productivity in the South than has the internet because it's very hard to do a lot of work when it's that hot. But in any case, if you want a sort of a tighter logical point, the internet is a single data point. yes, there's a sense in which there's been a lot of innovation, but of course that tells us nothing about whether there would have been a lot more had it been organized differently. And so it's just silly to point to a single data point. It's also clear if you do that, you can point to other things. Look at the iPhone. The iPhone is a closed system by almost any accounts, right? Steve Jobs is famously paranoid about things and a control freak. And yet the iPhone, almost anybody would say, has been is phenomenally innovative. And I think this is an important lesson here, the iPhone has tens of thousands of applications that are written by third-party developers because Apple knows that even though they want to keep control of the system, that doesn't mean innovating alone, and that control and management is consistent with having thousands of independent developers and innovators. And Apple has managed that, at least apparently, phenomenally successful, although I should say to myself, of course, that's only one data point. Maybe they could have done even better. But the fact is, when you see iPhone, iMode, if you look at video games, there was an open system. It was Atari. The open system led to crappy games and pornographic games and destroyed the system. Nintendo came along, switched the model to one of a managed system, which is what everyone has followed since, and they've all been much more successful. You know, as to innovation, I think if you look at the innovation that most people would see in handheld devices that are operating on managed networks, meaning PCS networks, cellular, whatever, there's been phenomenal innovation in that. And certainly my PC looks an awful lot more like the PC I had 10 years ago than my cell phone looks like. You know, one example people love to point out is the old AT&T. And old AT&T, right, did stifle innovation. But it seems to me the big lesson from that is not that closed systems are bad. It's the danger of monopoly. And I would include in that the danger of the monopoly of the state, which is why I think it'd be a really serious problem if the commission or government agencies generally try to mandate particular models and say, we know that openness is the right thing to do. Fortunately, in wireless, I think we have enough competition, enough competitors, that we are going to be able to see competition in action, and we will be able to see different business models and try it out. And let me close with just a prediction. And I predict that at least for the next 2 years, everyone will be claimed that when they wake up in the morning, the first thing they do is they ask themselves, how can I help a rural consumer? And most people won't mean it.
Thank you very much. Last but not least, we have Tom Shugrue. Tom is the Vice President of Government Affairs at T-Mobile USA. He is a former chief of the Federal Communications Commission's Wireless Bureau. And prior to his work at the FCC, he was Deputy Assistant Secretary of Commerce and Deputy Administrator of NTIA, where he advised the Assistant Secretary, the Secretary of Commerce, and the White House on communications and information issues. Prior to NTIA, Tom worked at the FCC for 6 years as the Chief of the Policy Division of the Common Carrier Bureau and as Special Counsel for Competitive Policies. Tom.
Well, Mike, I'm maybe the only person in the room old enough to actually worked on the breakup of AT&T back. So, and Spectrum ain't what it is in back in the old days, I tell you that, boy. I'm going to have a simple message, which is, you know, T-Mobile's a commercial provider. And whether there's a shortage in the economic sense or not, we certainly feel there's a shortage in our ability to get access to Spectrum. And maybe you put the two Michael's comments together, which is we don't really have a full market in Spectrum. We can't go buy Spectrum from people who are underutilizing it. We've got to get the government to reallocate it, and then they sell it to us. The prices for Spectrum have been very high lately. The government's run two major auctions for the mobile wireless industry in the last 2.5 years, which have garnered over $33 billion. And remember, that just gets you the right to, first of all, it just gets you the right to go through a very difficult process in trying to get the people who are still on that spectrum off. We spent the better part of 2 years and are still working it to sort of clear the band, both the lower band of government users and the upper part of private microwave users. But past that, you've also got billions, tens of billions of dollars in total, if you look at the industry of investment, then you've got to make in the infrastructure to make it work. So I would say the value of Spectrum is very high in our use, and I'd like to see it flow in some fashion. And if we had a full market, like some folks have suggested, that might be the way to do it. Short of that, though, we may need some regulatory and political intervention to sort of help that happen. Those two auctions, which were great, and I applaud the FCC and NTIA and the Congress and the government for making that happen, but it took 10 to 15 years for for that to all work out. I see my friend and former boss Larry Irving walked in the room back when he was assistant secretary, is when we started the process of the transfer spectrum that became the lower part of the AWS-1 band. And that was back, frankly, it started in the early 90s. And it just took that long to get the whole thing from about 93, 94 to 2006. So that's, 12, 13 years. The broadcast spectrum, which was auctioned off in 700, took from about, it was in 97, was that act, and then to 2008. And, of course, you're getting it in 2009. That's 10, 12 years. So my point is we really need to get to work on it right now. And I know the administration and the FCC got a lot on their plate. There's stimulus, there's broadband, there's all this. But we can't afford, I think, to wait another 10 to 12 years. We finally just got up to the point in our industry where we have about as much spectrum as there is allocated for these services in Europe and in Asia. But they are already set up to do their next major tranche of spectrum. In Germany, for example, they're going to auction off 300 megahertz of spectrum early. They're targeting sort of early 2010. That's a lot of spectrum in the 2.6 band. What they're calling their digital dividend, which is our version of the 700, when they shift to digital broadcasting, they'll have spectrum to auction off as well. So we're going to be, once again, very quickly behind in terms of access to this incredible resource. And what we're seeing is that it is bandwidth. And the more you sort of, the more capability you put out there, the more it just gets chewed up. We felt pretty good when we came out of the AWS-1 auction. We averaged about 52, 53 megahertz in the top 100 markets. And we're just seeing that being eaten up by our users, our friends and partners from Google with our Google phone, as it's sometimes called. They don't call it that, but the G1 phone. An average G1 user uses 50 times the amount of data that one of our average users on any other device, okay, 50 times and all. And iPhone has a store. Google has a store for those Android applications. People are just developing things, downloading things, which just gives a lot of functionality, whether it's games or services or whatever, but chews up bandwidth, you know, just bit by bit by megabit by megabit. So we're delighted about that. We love selling that service, all right, but we're going to need more spectrum, really, to make it work well. And maybe we can get to a real market reform and really have which may solve this, and there'll be trades made at marginal values and utility and so forth. But until then, I think we do need some attention paid to it at the government side. We're willing to work with that and to do it in an efficient manner. And but as I said, we need to sort of start that job, you know, tomorrow to really get it done in a timely fashion.
Great. Thank you very much. So I'll start with a couple questions, and please get your questions ready as well. Matthew, you mentioned your boss's great idea of the spectrum inventory. How do you envision this happening, or this becomes law, it starts to become implemented? How would Senator Snow, what kind of a result would make Senator Snow happy? Should we be measuring the intensity of use as the metric that we use? Would she want to be looking for things like white spaces or underlays and overlays beyond the broadcast bands? And how do you envision dealing in the government bands with things like receive-only radars that we've heard about, where use intensity of use may be harder to measure?
What did you just say? You'll have to forgive me. I mean, this is one of those things. You know, I'm kicking myself for not being an RF engineer instead of fiber optics engineer at Georgia Tech. I tell you, this is, you know, but they were walking around with those crazy copper and aluminum antennas, and I just like, it's tough enough, you know. But, no, I think really in all seriousness, what the center wants to do before we even address those is get a true baseline. I mean, I brought with me, you know, NTIA's, you know, manual on regulations and procedures for frequency radio management. It's, you know, just the PDF is 24 megs, 100 or 890 pages. You know, I did a search. It says accountability only twice because it cites GAO, and it says nothing about transparency or, you know, public accountability. And so I think that's one of the things, and that's what we've all talked about earlier in earlier sessions is, you know, spectrum, you know, is a public good. And so there has to be greater accountability to the public since, you know, it's theirs. It's in their interest. I mean, the FCC is, when they give licenses, they have to make sure it's in the public interest. And what we've seen is certainly the center wants to see, you know, a baseline, more up-to-date, more accurate information, and also information that the layman can easily interpret, where you don't need a PhD in RF engineering, because that's one of the things. You can go to, you know, the master list, NTIA, you can go to ULS, but it is incredibly complex from a user interface standpoint to try to ascertain the information you need. And that just seems, you know, just is the epitome of what, you know, bureaucracy does in, I guess, the government situation. And that's why there is a need, why the bill does call for a centralized effort, portal, if you will, for spectrum, because it's, you know, as the GAO said in one of their studies in, I think, 2006, is there's just no, you know, true, you know, decision maker. You know, you have the FCC that does non-federal, you have NTIA that does federal, but there's no hierarchical structure in that. And certainly, you know, maybe the hope is to have OSTP maybe take a greater role, since they are the ones that are involved in interagency development and strategy for technology and science. But to your point, you know, this is the first step. The second step is really to do true, tried and true measurements, as they've done over in the UK and in Europe, to really correlate the data they obtain from those measurements to the inventory, and then to do a utilization study to find out, you know, are we actually using it properly? And then the final step would be certainly to look at auction, you know, streamlining reallocation efforts, and making sure that, you know, that agencies are using it effectively and efficiently. So, you know, it's a multitude, and it'd be a little bit premature to get into specifics, but that is the, you know, overarching goal that the center and I think Kerry, Senator Kerry, certainly share.
Well, I can,
yeah, Michael, you
just mention on the same point, you know, to back up what Matt said is on transparency and having a public friendly interface. I mean, even that would be, you know, even without an inventory of the airwaves, even that would be a big step forward, because we had to, New America did a Citizen's Guide to the Airwaves some years ago as kind of graphical representation of just, you know, in broad strokes of who has what spectrum. And then we decided, well, okay, we want to drill down a little further into this. And we went to NTIA, and they said, well, first of all, you're going to have to fight us. You know, and they were, like, being very friendly, but you're going to have to fight us through an Freedom of Information Act process and maybe go to court before we give you anything at all. So we went through a whole series of FOIAs and got the National Security Archives to help us out on a pro bono basis. And then finally they gave us a disk from, you know, they call it the master file, which is like something out of the 1970s. You know, it's for, you know, it's for some, like, old, you know, old kind of computers. And they said, well, there's only even a few people at NTIA who even know how to use this programming because it's so antique. And it's all scrubbed, of course, of anything that any agency claims is sensitive. And NTIA doesn't question the agencies either. They just take their word for anything that they want to hide. So it's basically very difficult to see anything in the first place. And then the other, just a quick point, is I think when we do get to mapping, you know, there really should be layers. I mean, you know, the FCC process, for example, is you allocate first, you know, allocate, you know, for a use or a service. You want to see the allocations. Then you want to see a layer of, you want to see assignments. So who actually got the license, for example. You'd like to see, you know, some geographical breakdowns so that you can see in particular areas, which would be very illuminating, particularly for rural. And like I said, you'd really like to see some use measurements. I think the NTIA now only has either one or two trucks that in the whole country to be able to measure use of the you know, actual spectrum measurements, and we need more of that. And also it should have a wiki function, so that, because, for example, IIT in Chicago was doing their own longitudinal spectrum measurements there, so are lots of other people, and, you know, and the citizens can start populating the map itself at sort of a citizen layer.
Thanks. Larry, you mentioned that there were a couple things you mentioned that were problems with the current system. You mentioned concentration and centralized control in spectrum. Can you talk a little bit more about concentration, and if you could either take action right now to change something or push reset on the way that we've handled spectrum concentration in the past? How do you think we should address these issues, through the existing means, or do we have to do something in the post-spectrum cap era that's radically different than what we've done in the past?
Let me give one example. If you look at spectrum below a gigahertz that's licensed for carrier applications, really, and it kind of gets back to the point Tom made, these spectrum auctions, and it gets back to the innovation cycle, these spectrum auctions set the industry for 10, 15, 20 years. These are huge events that cast what's going to happen for 10 or 15 years. And those initial spectrum blocks that were at below a gigahertz went to two companies, and they were sold and resold, but they aggregated into two companies. You know, Verizon and AT&T basically have them now. And, you know, T-Mobile doesn't have much of it. There's a lot of other companies. Clearwire doesn't have much of it. And that's special spectrum. And that limits the ability of some of these companies, and it forces their hands in different ways. So there is and if you look at the unlicensed world, there's really almost no spectrum below a gigahertz that's unlicensed. And this is the special, well-propagating spectrum. So, you know, we've certainly been proponents of the TV white spaces to get some spectrum below a gigahertz to be used in an unlicensed fashion to complement what's going on in the higher frequencies, the 2.4 gigahertz and the 5 gigahertz range. So I think it's just a matter of getting more of this spectrum available, whether it's through an auction process, which is big national blocks, or it's through more of a process that's driven by, you know, regional pieces of spectrum that are aggregated together through some kind of a database process or an agile radio process. But right now you have a situation where this prime spectrum is really controlled by two companies. I don't know if people would dispute that. But
what do other panelists think? Is this an issue that we should be looking at as a where there might be a technology solution, where there might be white spaces or other innovative unlicensed uses? Or are we in more of an antitrust mode where there is excessive concentration and we should be thinking along those lines, although within the context of the FCC?
Well, I'll say something on that. I thought the question was whether there was a problem in need of a solution, and it seems like we've started with a solution and haven't identified a problem. And the fact is, it's right, whatever the allocation is, what the allocation is, but it was all subject to antitrust review. What I haven't heard, and I think what we could explore, and people can disagree on it, is what the problem is. But just saying that two companies have it, may just be pointing out that this is a business with big economies of scale and efficiencies. And so the question is, is there some reason to think that the DOJ made a mistake in approving the mergers? And I haven't heard anybody say they think there was, or if they can point to something. And then if there is, to ask, well, what would the alternative be? But to say, well, okay, let's apply antitrust, it's already been applied.
Well, one of my comments would be that I think it gets into spectrum being used for its best purpose and going away from kind of this one piece of spectrum or one network for all usage. The fact of the matter is the higher frequency spectrums do certain things well and the lower frequency spectrums, and you can have Wi-Fi and you can have macro cells. And putting those two networks together and having those networks work better together would also be a solution. And that would help companies that may only have a certain band of spectrum and they don't have access to those lower bands. And maybe it would help free up some of those lower bands that are being overused for purposes. You know, we have some applications that historically are sitting in low frequency bands just because they were very early applications, and they could well be in high frequency bands. It's just that they came out first, so they were in low frequency bands. And I think what needs to happen is that these companies that have a lot of capacity, they have a lot of spectrum and hybrid, they need just a little bit to get the coverage economically at the lower frequency. It's a coverage capacity trade-off.
Could I just say two things on that that are sort of current issues that are teed up? We are a high-frequency band, at least relative to this industry, carrier. All our spectrum's at either 1.9 or 1.7, 2.1. We don't have any below zero below 1 gigahertz. Two things on that, though. We're able to provide service very efficiently to covers about 85-90% of the population. That still leaves, the way this country works, about 50 or 60% of the landmass still not covered. Those frequency bands are fairly inefficient to cover rather sparsely populated and in some cases, topographically challenging environments. We have to depend on our roaming partners to deal with that. We have 850 spectrum in virtually all our phones now and all our devices for roaming purposes. Unfortunately, roaming becomes more difficult. We used to have a lot of roaming partners out in rural areas. This is one area maybe where the department should have looked a little more closely. It was sort of the tail on the dog, but just what the roaming markets happen. We now have essentially, and they're a good partner, so I don't want to, but, you know, we have one roaming partner in most of the country. And that also has something to do with the fact they're two technologies, essentially. So when there are two of them, you don't even get each one of them because they each use a different one. So you get one, essentially. So I think some look at roaming has to be done. And unfortunately, what the FCC did a few, now about 2 years ago, in reforming or addressing some roaming issues, it came up with a called the home market exclusion, which said there'll be no regulatory intervention if you have a spectrum license that covers the particular area you're seeking roaming rights in. And the problem is, of course, we have a national license now. It's in those upper bands that are not well suited. It's also the case that in some of those markets, the market's thin enough, you really can't support a third, far less a fourth or fifth. And if we were to enter, we'd often be at least the third and often the fourth or fifth entrant. So you need to address the – if you have an effective roaming market, either through competition or through some even light-handed regulation, I think you can sustain a very competitive market in the vast majority of the country. Second is there are – and this is just one little issue, but it's sort of getting some attention out, and that's the D block. There is 10 megahertz of spectrum left at the 700, which was set aside for a different purpose. It was going to be this public-private partnership for public safety. That didn't work. My own view is that probably never will work for various reasons. I mean, we can get into a debate about that, and it was well-intentioned, I think, but for various reasons, I don't think that's the best way to go. I think the better way to go would be to just use that for commercial purposes. That's what the statute really says. It has to be auctioned anyway. You could use the proceeds for public safety. What public safety lacks, frankly, is less – it lacks money more than it lacks spectrum. It has 24 megahertz at 700 that's just going to be opened up. You could auction off that D block for between $2 and $6 billion, just using the various valuations of the different blocks in 700. If I were the czar of public safety and you offered me $2 to $6 billion, which I can use for technology and for build out and develop that band, or 10 megahertz additional spectrum in no money, I would definitely take the money, at least from where I sit and from my experience with our friends in public safety. So I think we need to get that alternative back on the table as a possible. Now, that doesn't solve all the issues, but it is a very valuable slice of spectrum that is sort of out there sitting hanging.
Can I say one
word? Yeah, please.
So, Tom, I want to say one thing. I do have a T-Mobile phone. What I love is that, in fact, I don't get coverage in this room from the macro cell. But the phone allows me to connect to Wi-Fi. And I connect to Wi-Fi and get all the services transparently, voice. And so that's an example where, you know, the spectrum doesn't penetrate down into this lower basement, but there's at least another solution. So there are other solutions. It's not all doom and gloom. And that's somewhat where the openness comes in. A carrier willing to put in the Wi-Fi or put in the other technology and allow these network work together has been a bit rare, and it's just something that's happening now and something that I'd like to see encouraged.
We have questions from the audience. Please. Can people hear him? No, microphone.
You guys were getting into the subject of about opening new spectrum blocks, and I'm just wondering, isn't the problem really going to be long term? There's going to be to try to get more spectrum from the government. There's going to be a lot of pushback, especially from DOD. I mean, if you look at what NTIA did last year to compile information on what's out there, I mean, even with that, DOD was reluctant to turn over any information. And I'm just wondering, is it expected that there's going to be a pretty epic battle down the road to get much of anything more from the government, even with all these plans to do mapping and you know, try to do inventorying and that kind of thing?
Well, certainly that's expected, but the center obviously being on the Intel committee, and you know, we are keeping a very open dialogue with DOD to try to work with them. I think that they do possibly share some of the goals that the center has in regards to spectrum, and it is just a touchy situation, obviously, because there are critical infrastructure and communication needs that they do use parts of the spectrum for. But I think it's also looking at, well, what about the Department of Interior, the forestry agency? I mean, if they have 10 megahertz and they're saying it's national security, I think there needs to obviously be a clear justification of that. And that's what certainly the bill calls for. But, we are certainly keeping an open dialogue with DOD to see how we can kind of assuage any concerns that they do have. So,
I mean, I think the lesson, it will be difficult. It's not impossible. It has been done before. I mean, we definitely applaud the goals of the Kerry Snow bill. I mean, one thing I think that is missing from there is sort of a therefore at the end. And when this is over, the federal government should transfer 200 megahertz, and the FCC should identify 200 megahertz, because right now is only there's a study, and then you do the study, and then you do the study again 2 years later, and I understand what the purpose of it is to allow that, but it'd be, I think, a more complete picture if it actually provided that at the when we complete this study. The other thing, just to be candid, these studies don't. They're harder to do than it sounds like. There are no standards to do these contour maps, for example. Believe me, the first go round at this will just be complete junk, and it won't be useful for much of anything. And then we'll have to do another one, and we could spend the next 3 or 4 years trying to get the implementation of this right. And I'm not saying this in any. I'm just looking at working for a company who needs spectrum, quick. That maybe we could have a parallel path, and just maybe the government can say instead of 200, find 100, okay? And I said this to Michael. I mean, yes, if the five of us on this panel got together, we could find 100 megahertz on the government side and 100 megahertz on the private side that could be transferred without any real sort of blood being let out of national security or anything else, and in about an afternoon's time. And I'd like to get that process going while we sort of do a more comprehensive thing. So.
Other questions?
I've got a question about the claim that unlicensed spectrum is somehow consistent with efficient use of spectrum. I mean, I think that's the real issue, is that because there's not any new spectrum, it's important to use whatever spectrum we use as efficiently as possible. And over time, what we've learned is that advances in coding primarily enable us to use spectrum.
I'll take a crack at that. I think one thing we've seen is that unlicensed spectrum has been very effective in the local area networks. And the licensed spectrum has been very effective in the macrocellular. The licensed spectrum has started out when you're in your car. You were happy to get coverage in your car. And even in the 90s, you mostly had to go stand by the window to get coverage and so forth. So the macro cell is really good for the wide area coverage, and they work hard, and they do a good job to get in building and so forth, but it's hard to get everywhere. And what they're seeing is that a lot of the carriers are saying, wow, the way to offload my capacity, I've got capacity problems on my macro cell, is get people using a microcell that could be a femtocell, but those aren't widely deployed left. That could be an in-building network, but I can't deploy all in-buildings. So a lot of times they're using Wi-Fi as a capacity offload. So I think that's an example where the unlicensed spectrum is taking the demands off of the licensed spectrum, and it's to the benefit of both.
But when you deploy in the white spaces frequencies, you know, if you wanted those white spaces frequencies because you wanted more propagation. I mean, not that they automatically give you that. You actually have to have a power level that's consistent with high propagation in order to get that. But I think the goal that's in the back of Michael's mind and in a lot of other people that have been advocates for white spaces is they want an unlicensed third party. They want wide area networks that are using those wide space frequencies. And when we get into the wide area networks, and you're going to have to deal with these problems, you're going to have a tragedy of the commons scenario on your hands if you don't go into that with some strategy for managing the bandwidth.
I mean, it can access to unlicensed can, you know, facilitate new entrants. I mean, there are thousands. There may be a few big national carriers, but there's, you know, literally thousands of WISPs and community networks and hotspot providers and others who are only in business. They're only providing all that connectivity and service because they could get, you know, that open, shared, free access to the public airwaves. And although I think, you know, your sort of assumption is rationing, you know, And I guess I probably wouldn't disagree that rationing can force greater efficiency on a given band, and that's exactly what's happened to the commercial carriers like T-Mobile and so on. Because the government has rationed their access to the airwaves, they've had an incentive to get increasingly efficient on those particular bands, but there isn't actually a shortage, an overall shortage of spectrum. And so what we need is to optimize and, you know, a number of different purposes here, you know, not only spectrum efficiency, but also, you know, spectrum access, and for a whole variety of different purposes. So right now we don't see that there's really a trade-off, that really the best thing is the balance between the licensed and the unlicensed and the different models that engenders.
I think we have time for one more question. In the back. There's auction reform, there's the spectrum cap that we're all familiar with from the past, and then we've talked about the antitrust.
Well, I like that NFL draft thing here, because we're the fourth largest, we're the fourth out of four, so I think we get the number one pick. So give me that big block of 40 megahertz at 700 at New York
like
City.
Redskins, pardon? What? Are you going to choose poorly like the Redskins?
Yeah, right. I hope we'll do better than that. Auctions, in my mind, are a little bit like, you know, Churchill's description of democracy, the worst possible form of government except compared to all other possible forms of government. There are a lot of problems with auctions, but in my mind, they're the best technique we have. You can tweak them around this way or that way, but I haven't seen anything that's better than those, at least as the core principle. And yes, you could overlay if you wanted to, and I'm not endorsing them, but caps or things like that. But at ground level, how do you decide who gets this license? And I do think you'd still need licensed spectrum. The need for that isn't going to go away. I would still use auctions.
And well, given that the government is facing a $1-point-some-odd-trillion debt, auctions are pretty good. I think there is, the FCC did decide to start doing auctions instead of lotteries and that, I guess back in 94. It's been 15 years. There may be a need to reevaluate, just see. Maybe there's a way to kind of harmonize those efforts to make it more equitable for some of the smaller carriers that do want to gain a larger, more regional or national presence. But, it may be, premature to really, go down that path without more data to really, ascertain what options do totally exist. So.
I think we have time for, I've been given the hook, so we have time for one last comment.
Just to say, because the spectrum cap has come up a couple of times, and I know people who are proponents of it view it as being pro-consumer and pro-competition, but I think you need to remember how a spectrum cap would work, or one of the implications of it is that if you have carriers that because they're succeeding in attracting consumers and are being successful as competitors, that may be the driving force why they need more spectrum. And then so to have a policy that says, okay, you're allowed to get this big and no bigger is also a policy that says once you get to that size, screw your consumers because you've got no incentive to get any more of them. So I think it needs to be kept in mind that the spectrum cap, despite its intentions, can have actually pretty strong anti-consumer consequences.
Okay, well, thank you to all of our panelists.